Getting back to the Bolshevik Revolution, one of the ironies of it is that both Lenin and Trotsky were in exile, one in Germany, one in the United States. Tell us about how, who helped them get where they were going to make sure that revolution was pulled off.
Well, let me summarize about four chapters into 4 minutes. Trotsky was in New York. He had no income. I summed his income for the year he was in New York. It was about $600. Yet he lived in an apartment. He had a chauffeured limousine. He had a refrigerator, which is very rare in those days. He left New York and went to Canada on his way to the revolution. He had $10,000 in gold on him. He didn't earn more than $600 in New York. He was financed out of New York. There's no question about that. The British took him off the ship in Halifax, Canada. I got the Canadian archives. They knew who he was. They knew who Trotsky was. They knew he was going to start a revolution in Russia. Instructions from London came to put Trotsky back on the boat with his party and allow them to go forward. So there is no question that Woodrow Wilson, who issued the passport for Trotsky, and the New York financiers who financed Trotsky, and the British Foreign Office allowed Trotsky to perform his part in the revolution. Now, over in Switzerland, you get Lenin, who was in exile. He went through Germany in the famous sealed train by permission and with the encouragement of the German general staff. And yet Germany and Britain were supposed to be fighting each other. And you get them both moving these two key revolutionaries into place inside Russia. And then, of course, the rest is history. They created the revolution. With no more than about 10,000 revolutionaries, they needed assistance from the West, and they got assistance from Germany, from Britain, and from the United States to continue and consolidate the revolution.
Welcome back. Another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Jay Dyer back on the show. He returns to discuss a couple of lectures he's recently given on his program regarding Anthony Sutton's breakthrough research regarding the Bolshevik Revolution. It's Anthony Sutton's Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. He also did a lecture regarding the Fabians and sort of the Fabian conspiracy, a very interesting book, which I was looking for the title and it's not unavailable.
Somebody found it on a European bookseller for $13. So there is one bookstore in the world that has it.
Oh, really? European? Okay. Yeah.
Somebody found it on my Discord. I'll have to find that link and give it to you. But
Okay. Yeah,
there was somebody randomly mentioned it on Twitter, and then I happened across it looking through Amazon for books on the history of the Fabian Society. And this turned out to be a gem. This is a guy who, you know, I think.
What's the title again? The full title?
Full title is The Milner Fabian Conspiracy: How an International Elite is Taking Over and Destroying Europe, America, and the World, by a Romanian author, Ioan Ratiu, or Ratiu is spelled R A T I U.
So it's about 10 years old.
Well, yeah, except that he did the version I have is second edition of 2016.
Okay, so it's fairly recent. A lot's happened since then.
But it's like this was a really, really well done work. I have to give this guy a lot of credit. I mean, he really did. It's another one of these hundreds and hundreds of footnotes, probably 500, maybe not 500, maybe 300 or 400 footnotes. So really well documented, and he has a really good grasp of, a lot of the materials that we've talked about over the years, and materials that I've, he quotes Quigley a lot. He's quoting Sutton a lot. He quotes a lot of the history works on British intelligence, Stephen Dorrell and all these guys. So he's really done his homework. It's great. It's perfect in the vein of Sutton research and Quigley research.
Yeah. So with Anthony Sutton, of course, the his book, he proved sort of the tangible historical links between the Bolsheviks, the communists in Russia, and Wall Street, these U.S. capitalist bankers. And he pretty much, he dug up all the files, canceled checks, cable. Receipts, showing that the cables. So the Bolsheviks had ample support from the West to carry out a revolution against a supposed ally in the First World War. So during, in the midst of this war, the Western allies, the Triple Entente, if you will, and of course then the United States after 1917, are working at least elements within, I have to say that, because it's not like Americans are doing this, are working to undermine at that point, the Kerensky government, provisional government. And it's interesting that Sutton points out that they were calling it provisional, meaning they intended to overthrow the government, right? Never thought of it. I always thought it was provisional past tense, because what happened, they were calling it provisional then. So Anthony Sutton's research, a lot of people are kind of familiar with it in our circles, but you cover the book, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, the West supported the sort of the communist revolution, gives us the false dialectic of the 20th century, the Cold War. But I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, I think that, as you said, a lot of people are very familiar with it. It's one of the kind of, conspiracy classics, you could say, illustrating the false dialectic between communism and capitalism, because usually Marxist socialist movements, they almost always have, big capital behind them and select interests that are more powerful, that have no interest in the ideals of egalitarianism and communism or whatever. So, yeah, the whole thesis, as everybody probably knows, is that monopoly capital is the real source of the energy behind Marxism, socialism. That's pretty much been true from the very beginning, right? From Marx and Engels themselves. You could even perhaps go back further to Adam Weishaupt and the communism that he was advocating. Also, according to Quigley, had support from elite banking houses even back then. So, yeah, I think that this is a classic text for understanding the false left-right dialectic in terms of monetary support and funding. It is a Cold War text, but it goes against the narrative of what most Cold Warriors and people involved in the Cold War were thinking, right? I mean, I don't think hardly anybody thought that, the source of Marxism socialism was the elite families of the West. That's really the thesis of the book. And, he wrote it in 1974. It's not a conspiracy text. He was the archivist of Congress in the 1950s. He went to the sources, the documents, the cables, the, bank receipts, all kinds of stuff. So even though it is a Cold War era text, it came out in 1974, it's really just an economist, Professor Sutton, writing about what he discovered and discovering that, hey, wait a minute, maybe this left-right going on in the Cold War is a bit of a managed dialectic. And he links it to corporate welfare, to socialism, and how, the thought process that communism, Marxism is antithetical to monopoly capital is just false. They have identical goals. So there really is no reason actually to believe that there's opposition between banking elite and Marxism socialism. So he links the bankers to Trotsky, he links them to Lenin, to pretty much all the revolutionary movements, including even predecessors to Bolshevism, such as the Mexican Revolution, the Revolution of Sun Yat-sen, were also Wall Street fund revolutions. And he goes pretty deep into the relationship with Woodrow Wilson as essentially a banker agent for what will turn out to be the Milner-Fabian circles. So he pretty much just goes chapter by chapter through the different revolutionaries, their backers, and the specific corporations and families, and even the location of, what does he call it, 120 Broadway, which is really where all of this revolutionary stuff was being run. Now, that's where it was being run in the U.S. It was also being co-run in London as well. So, yeah, it's a text that we talk about a lot, but really needs to be in-depth analyzed because it fits so well with the Quigley and, the rest of these texts that I've been covering.
Yeah, Trotsky was actually kept up in high lifestyle in New York at a time when he, in 1916, 1917, had a limousine, a refrigerator. It was very rare at the time in his apartment.
They traveled in a fancy way. He was sassy. He was fancy, prancing around. And he, at one point, got $10,000 from these anonymous, mysterious, quote, German elites. And this is the source of the theory that many have that supposedly Trotsky was an agent of Germany. And when we say agent of Germany here, people who don't know the whole depth of this and background think that, oh, you're covering up by the fact that he was working for Jewish agents and you're saying it was Germans. No, that's not what I'm saying. This is actually part of the history that people thought he was a German agent. And this is during the period when it would have been. So there was a brief period where there was a revolution in Germany, right? And you had the Spartacist uprising where they had this brief period of a quote Spartacist Illuminist communist government. Right? So there was quite a bit of support for Marxism in Germany at this time. So when I say, and it turns out, according to Sutton, what's actually going on here is that this so-called passing of money through Germany was just a cover. This was actually coming from the Swedish banker Olof Aschberg. So they were basically funneling the money through Germany so that it would look like it was German support when it was actually this, and he is of Jewish descent, Olof Aschberg, funneling the money through Germany to Trotsky. So that's what was going on. That's the source of the theory that Trotsky was a German agent. But then it turns out that this leads partially to the division between Trotsky and Stalin, because Stalin figures some of this out.
Yes.
Stalin then says that Trotsky is actually an agent of Western capital.
And he wasn't really, really off there.
Exactly. And are you familiar with the Rakovsky interrogation?
That's the Red's Red's Symphony, right?
Yeah, and that happened under Stalin as well. And so, although I don't think anybody can be infallibly sure as to whether that document is authentic or part of propaganda, again, it also backs this up, right? Because the guy who's being interrogated basically says the same thing, right? He says, this is we're working as part of big capital to bring in a world government. And so, yeah, again, backing up the thesis, which apparently the Stalin government was beginning to figure out, which was that these guys were agents of Western capital.
And Trotsky's return to Russia in 1917 after the February revolution, where the Tsar abdicated, was facilitated by American and the British governments, Woodrow Wilson, and of course at the same time you have Lenin and the famous sealed train coming out of Switzerland. This was the German operation. That's what history tells us. And you can see the logic behind Germany sending Lenin into Russia as sort of a bacillus to knock Russia out of the war. But it doesn't make sense that the U.S. and Britain, British officials would send Trotsky to Russia. So they had to do this trick with sort of a money laundering trick. But it appears that it's Germans doing it.
Right.
But really, at the end of the day, the level we're talking about is the German state versus the American government or the British state aren't meaningful, because you have these transnational bankers. A good example would be the Warburg family, who, Warburg controls the German central bank during the war. And you have Paul Warburg, I think, head of the New York Fed during the First World War, and they're brothers. Mm-hmm. You start, wait a second.
Actually read in the diary, yeah, the Warburg diaries, the entries about they're happy at the success of their funding of the Bolshevik Revolution. So mm-hmm. on record in their diaries.
And Sutton talks about, you know, the motivation here. So why would these capitalists, people believe in free enterprise? Well, they really don't believe in free enterprise, not the way Anthony Sutton advocates free enterprise, the way that libertarians would. I mean, that's free market, entrepreneurial, they're monopoly capitalist. And Russia at the time represented a system that was outside sort of the Western banking system. I think the Russian Central Bank, a lot of gold reserves, not to mention the resources in Russia. And he says this is a way to knock Russia out, kind of keep it from developing further, sort of turn a form of disaster capitalism to just create havoc in Russia so they can go in and buy resources, pennies on the dollar, which is an old, you know, a trick we see played out throughout, you know, recent history, actually.
Yeah. And by the way, I just remembered here at the beginning that Sutton on page 36, he cites that Rakovsky interrogation, the reason. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. I underlined that, but I forgot that. And I just saw that. And by the way, I'm sure you know this, but Sutton also mentioned the possibility of Woodrow Wilson being blackmailed and, you know, for presumably sexual stuff. And that's probably why he was so easily cajoled, you know, by Colonel Edwin Mandel House, who was essentially an asset of the Milner Rothschild banking industrial complex of the UK, right? They sent House to be that agent, and, you know, Wilson just completely caved to all the
stuff. Bernard Baruch, and this also factors into the Balfour Declaration, basically the promise, the then Zionist movement getting Britain to endorse, you know, them getting called Palestine, and you had various Jewish interests in the United States saying they could leverage their power to get the country into the war, which would suggest that's what the blackmail was, you know, perhaps getting the country, because Wilson campaigned in 1916 as he kept us out of war.
Right.
And then I think he is inaugurated in March. Back then, presidents were inaugurated in March, and within a month, the U.S. is at war with Germany. Yeah. Then you have Churchill's intrigues regarding Lusitania a couple years before, which, you know,
Wilson obtained the passport for Trotsky.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So, yeah, I mean, clear, obvious support and collusion. And then he mentions that some of the companies early on involved in the early stage of the revolution after that, getting the passport for Trotsky, was Crane Company and Westinghouse Company. And the key point here is that the reason, and Sutton says this clear as day, at least a couple of times in the book, you know, this is not hard to figure out. Why would all these monopoly capitalists be supporting Marxist socialist Bolshevism? Well, because they wanted a stake in divvying up the resources when there's a new government.
Mm-hmm. Didn't Harriman get control of the manganese or something?
Did what?
Harriman get control of the bank, get this huge manganese concession? Of the icons and treasures were being sold off, and, you know,
he says they just wanted access to all the resources and markets.
Yeah.
That shows that that means that communism, Marxism, its funders knew that it wasn't actually going to be doing that.
Yes, it's
in other words, they knew it was a consolidation scam to just transfer all that wealth and ownership over offshore. That's it.
It was with the American International Corporation, which was kind of like the clearinghouse for a lot of this.
Absolutely.
And the exploitation of the Red Cross, right?
Correct. This was the early phases of pioneering that usage of NGO, right? Humanitarian aid organization as a covert operation. So you're absolutely right. The American Industrial Corporation, JP, which was a JP Morgan outfit, he points out, was millions of dollars, $2 million through the Red Cross, he says in the Lenin chapter, chapter three, to support the Bolsheviks. So,
yeah, I think he points out that the Red Cross commission or mission to Russia was dominated by bankers not
yeah, exactly.
No doctors.
Financiers. Yeah, it's like doctors with borders. Like, well, is it really, is it a bunch of spies or is it
doctors? but yeah, basically destabilize Russia. And he makes the point that there is an attempt in history to kind of rewrite history to present Russia as being primitive and backwards. We get a lot of that in Russia, but he says that actually Russia was a very dynamic at that time, coming up with technology, even airplane, aerodynamics and things. And the Tsarist regime was actually much more dynamic than presented to students of history today. So we think that it was the backwardness and inefficiency of the Tsarist system. It couldn't cope with the stresses of the war, which led to the problems. Obviously, the war created the ripe conditions for revolution in Russia and St. Petersburg and these things. But the idea, again, this is just to make something, it was inevitable, sort of just the stochastic events, the events hitting to one another, and what can you do, right? Who could have foreseen this? That sort of thing.
Yeah. And then he points out that, again, the J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, the Rhodes circles, Olaf Ashberg was the one he's known as the Bolshevik banker. Mm-hmm. These guys are, and so he's a Swedish banker, not Swedish, he's Jewish Swedish banker, together with his Morgan, Rockefeller, Rhodes circles cohorts, which includes also Lord Rothschild, by the way. They're all working together for the same ends. And so it's multiple interests converging on the desire to cause a revolution and then turn it into a quote free democratic society, right? Because everybody uses this terminology of democracy. And what does that sound like? Well, it sounds exactly like what just happened in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Anthony Sutton also makes a point where a lot of we get the impression that the factories in Russia were all destroyed, and they weren't. What happens? The Bolsheviks they went and they murdered all the engineers, or everyone left. And this is basically the chasing out of Russian talent leaves it open for others to come in and exploit, develop it and take it over, and which the West kind of did with the 5-year plans and the industrialization that occurred in the Soviet Union under Stalin. These plants were built by Westinghouse and Ford and these things, they built it up and they created, they helped industrialize Russia. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, it's like it was, if you read Kerry Bolton, he sees Stalin as sort of a accidental hero in preventing the New World Order, because he actually, in kicking out Trotsky, kicked out these foreign conspirators and actually nationalized the Soviet, Soviet Union became sort of a national system. As bad as it was, Stalin kicked out the internationalists.
And the early, Stalin and Lenin, Trotsky and Lenin, the early revolutionaries are internationalists.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a shift in Stalin's approach to, while he does intend to be an internationalist in the sense of running an international NKVD spy network, he also understands that the internationalism for the domestic population was destructive. And that was the mistake of Lenin and Trotsky. And that's exactly why he didn't. I mean, this is, like you said, going along with Bolton's thesis and other people's analysis. That's why he flipped on this on these guys, because he saw them as agents of Western capital. Now, that doesn't mean that Sovietism or communism is good, but the point is that it did appear that he was recognizing some of these points, because even his own spies were getting these interrogations and coming to this conclusion.
Yeah, and this is something you'd expect, because these schemers and monopoly capitalists and Fabians think they can manage and control the world. The world's very dynamic, and then you do have a situation where they can't control everything, and so you a character like Stalin going off script a little bit,
And by the way, this Bolshevik satanic stuff is so toxic that it has to give way to dictatorship, because that's always what happened. Even the philosophers realized that democracy and anarchy, which is essentially what these things are, they're so bad that they immediately give way to dictatorship and oligarchical tyranny. So you're going to get a Stalin out of all this, because this stuff is so destructive that you can't but figure out that it's, you know, it's there to make everything collapse.
So you need a dictator with a sword to cut the Gordian knot, you know.
Right. We and can't deal with all this. And they purge all these crazies, right? So when they come to power, they purge all these complete wackos.
That's like all that, all the like crazy feminism and free love stuff that the Bolsheviks introduced was stopped because Stalin realized that society was collapsing. You know, exactly. It's a lot slower in the West because there's a lot more, I guess, social capital and physical capital wealth to squander over several generations. Whereas Russia was too marginal that there was immediate collapse, and so all of a sudden there's a sort of a conservative reaction in terms of values. All the cultural Marxist stuff was booted out. You know.
One thing I didn't realize until I read the Ratiu text, which we'll talk about, I guess, in a little bit, but the stuff that the critical school Frankfurt Marxists, they were actually late to the game in terms of what people call cultural Marxism. It was actually the Fabians who were way ahead of time promoting the degeneracy. And they were even prior to the Bolsheviks. In fact, the Fabian Society and George Bernard Shaw were pushing the cultural and artistic degeneracy like in the 1890s. So they were actually ahead of they were doing it prior to even Lenin and the Bolsheviks pushing a lot of the cultural degeneracy and even the outright at times satanic stuff. Because some of the Bolsheviks, like Gleb Bokiai, they were actually into Satanism.
Yeah. And even throughout, I mean, with this, Anthony Sutton later did research about, Western aid. The best enemies money can buy or something. And he talks about even in the height of the Vietnam War, you had Western companies supporting, you know, the North Vietnamese and the Soviet Union and the transfer of technology. Not to mention Lend-Lease, by the way. Of course, that was the cover of World War II, but huge resources going to the Soviet Union to prop up the enemy.
That's because they had decided then they wanted the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's when
they decided, okay, we'll go with this, yeah.
Yeah, they unconditional surrender with Germany, so they destroy German power, bring Red Army into the heart of Europe and go, oh, gee, who could have foreseen that? I don't know, did you look at a map, fellas? It's like, what did you think was going to happen? And of course, his other work, like Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, Wall Street and FDR, is basically these oligarchs are funding these political figures who may, from time to time, go off script. Again, this is a complex world, and it isn't like they're puppets, you know. And so they have to, they go off script, they have to be destroyed. Like Hitler went off script. I didn't expect France to fall so fast. And, you know, oh no, he's invading Russia, he might win. So now everything changes. Some people suspect that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was, although he was ill, Stalin convinced he was assassinated. The advocates of FDR, I'm not a big fan of FDR, so I'm not too concerned about that. But yeah, it's interesting that, you know, again, these political figures may not be completely under their control at the time.
One thing I didn't understand that was a little unclear to me, which you might could clear up. I talked to Mark Hackett a lot about this because he knows a lot about it. But I don't know a lot about like the history of German espionage. So I'm not really sure. And I don't, maybe it's because I read the first few chapters several months ago, but what was Sutton's point, if you recall, about the prevalence of the German spy networks in America? Was that just kind of because they were basically prepping for World War I? But I was a little confused as to how the German spy networks that he mentions on pages 64, 65, and 66 relates to all this stuff with the Bolsheviks.
Oh, well, I mean, I think that might have something to do with the fact that there were so many Germans in the United States, ethnic Germans. And the idea, this was early into the Great Rapprochement, where it wasn't assumed the United States would be an ally of Great Britain.
Oh, I see.
And by the way, the Eastern seaboard establishment was Anglophile, the Midwest.
So the German spy networks would have wanted to court and get the America on the German.
Okay. And actually, Jews in the United States were very pro-German, because of their ancestral hatred of Russia because of the pogroms and the stories, you know, that they have of oppression in Russia and Tsarist Russia parallels of the settlement. It wasn't until the Balfour Declaration, the promise of Palestine, that Jewish support switched on a dime to oppose the Central Powers. And that was key to getting America into the war. So this latent Jewish power in the United States at the time. Even like, you know, Supreme Court justices were scheming behind the scenes to get this done. Bernard Baruch and Samuel Untermeyer, who had a publishing empire, he actually produced the Schofield Bible to get become Christian Zionists. So there's a huge propaganda technique, psychological warfare technique going on behind the scenes. It's very, people don't realize just at how early on I was working with, you know, the media at the time was being manipulated behind the scenes. And you know, J.P. Morgan, of course, tied in with Rothschild and the British Empire. And it's hard to really identify what's the true nature of the British Empire at this point. Is it a cover for Rothschild interests, you know? And this is where you get the Jewish banking.
More and more thinking that it's a cutout kind of for just the Rothschilds. But
yeah. And the Rothschild and people like Churchill families were heavily in debt to Jewish creditors. Then you get into that. So that's a whole, this obviously isn't one thing, but it factors into it. You mentioned like communists. It's funny how these communists are supposedly fighting, you know, for the worker to unseat capitalist, and they're being funded by outside interests, capitalist interests. You have the same dynamic in South Africa. Outside interests like the Oppenheimer interest, where they're using to unseat the Afrikaner national government, supposedly to bring in, you know, equal rights for blacks and a democracy. But the problem is the Afrikaner government, forever its problems, was a national government, control of its assets, had a central bank with gold, and they destroy that government, and they bring in all these black nationalists. You know, the ANC takes control. ANC is just a tool of Oppenheimer. And now the government is there fit to be plundered, because the new government's much more corrupt and easily more pliable. And even Nelson Mandela would talk about how he was supported by capitalists.
Stephen Dorrell says Nelson Mandela was recruited by British intelligence.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's a latter day Fabian. And so was Indira Gandhi, right? I mean, not Indira Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi.
Mahatma Gandhi was, yeah.
Yeah, they're all Fabian. So it gets that Fabian thesis, you know, using democracy and human rights to destroy governments. And again, none of these events occur in a vacuum. You have all these outside interests that are manipulating that. And so Africa, you know, the whole history of South Africa really was a national state created by, you know, Dutch and British settlers, and then they brought in cheap labor and created the demographic problem, using cheap labor to swamp the country and change the country's politics. That speaks to like Cecil Rhodes and the Jameson raids and all that, and the run up to the Boer War. But most people have no understanding the history of South Africa. They think it was like the United States Civil Rights Movement. You know, very different. But they destroyed that government. The government was a national government. And they internationalized South Africa, and of course, the rest, as they say, is history.
I remembered the one of the connections for the German spy networks and this stuff, and that's this figure of Count Jacques Menotto, who is a key link between the German banks and the Bolsheviks. And so you have foreign espionage agents who are tied to Bolsheviks and to these various governments.
Mm-hmm.
German espionage agents in 1915 and 16 were being run by this Count Menotto figure. But he has a connection apparently to the Bolsheviks. So again, there seems to be double playing both sides here, because people that would be funding fascism eventually would also be funding Bolshevism.
Yeah.
People have a hard time figuring out, but.
And the whole idea of the Ukraine, this is the sort of, I think what I understand is this is sort of the whole Ukrainian nationalism came out of the German general staff in World War I. This has to do with their conquest of that territory they got under Brest-Litovsk.
Yeah, so didn't Lenin hand it over?
Yeah, and there was basically to get peace with the Germans.
Yeah.
And so they come in, and for a short while, they take most of Ukraine. And this frees up troops that for the Ludendorff offensive that ultimately fails in the spring of 1917 and leads, of course, to the German surrender. You know, or actually, they sue for peace and never actually surrendered World War I. They sued for peace under the terms of 14 points, and then the Allies turned the tables on them. And then you had local elements. Again, you had a color revolution inside Germany,
right?
That leads to the Kaiser abdicating.
And keep in mind, I forget who it was. Maybe it was you or somebody on your show. I don't remember. Or maybe it was, but I was talking to Jim Jotris about it. And no, it was Richard Grove reminded me of this. If anyone doubts Sutton's research, I'll have you know that Zbig himself, in Between Two Ages, cites this very book and backs up Sutton's research. So
yes. It's interesting because Sutton, a lot of work, research regarding trilateralism in the 1970s. Yeah. And he did this with, I guess he must have been a young man at the time, but Robert Wood.
Yeah, the
Technocracy Rising guy.
Yeah.
He met Sutton at some sort of gold conference in the
70s. Yeah, I was listening to Patrick interviewed him the other day, and he was talking about working with Anthony Sutton. I didn't realize that.
And they were right about trilateralism. Of course, trilateralism is, if you look at trilateralism, it's just latter-day modernized Fabianism, monopoly capitalism, the same old trick. You know, because at the time, I think America... I think what is it? America has like 33 or 35 representatives of the Trilateralist Commission, and I think a dozen of them were in the Carter administration. You know, Carter being a Trilateralist himself. Yeah.
So there was this.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead.
So who was it? Who'd you say, Carter? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And
yeah. Is there a delay? I don't know. I don't mean to cut you off.
No, I'm just being rude. Go ahead, talk.
No, go ahead.
No, I'm just, go ahead.
So, no, there's like two or three trains of thought in my mind right now. I'm trying to bring them together. I'm trying to remember this, again, the place of the German stuff. So the Spartacist revolution in Germany happened in 1918. So I think what was going on was that they were trying to trigger this internationally. And this is mentioned in the Ratio book, too, that they wanted... 1917, 1918 Germany. They wanted this to be the whole world. And they probably wanted something like this in the US as well. Right. Mm-hmm. So they probably, I don't know how successful the Marxists were in the US. I don't think they pulled that off or could have pulled that off. But I don't think the Spartacist revolt was very successful either. Right. They tried to start it, but it kind of petered out right away.
Yeah. You had the Freikorps come in and suppress the Munich Soviet. And I think, is that where Rosa Luxemburg was put to the wall or something? Was so. It? Yeah. Okay. Or did she die in Russia?
In one of my Marxist classes, I can't remember. But
yeah, but you had all these communists in Germany that were, basically they just, they weren't feckless. They killed and put it down in the early 20s. Yeah, you know. And of course, then you have the Weimar period and talk about the culture degradation, which actually factors into ultimately the rise of Hitler in Germany because it's a reaction to all the degradation.
Exactly. Well, and it's portrayed in the TV, in that TV show, Babylon Berlin, which we covered. That I did a whole analysis. I think it's two or three seasons, but that whole show takes place from this. They mentioned the Reds and the Spartacists and whatnot, but it's taking place right at the height of the Weimar Republic before. So I guess it's taking place in the 20s and 30s, but yeah, they actually do portray the degeneracy.
You have the great inflation, which is used to sort of
the money,
steal resources, more or less rob Germany blind.
Well, they even have the stock guy in the show. The third season ended with them rigging the stock market to buy everything up after a collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And they said their model was the U.S. model. Which is kind of funny, right? But the funny thing is that it's kind of all in the show in a coded way. It's like the show is telling you that the monopoly elites are kind of rigging this on purpose.
Mm-hmm. And
the reason they're collapsing the country, they have this main figure guy who ends up being one of the funders of the fascists, of the Axis in the show. He's actually literally saying, oh, I'm going to crash the economy to buy everything up on the cheap. So but to get back to the Sutton book, the these two pages are, in my view, a couple of the most important, at least in what I've been looking at recently, which is 91, 92, 93, because here we have this, the mention of the change in policy of the British government under Lloyd George, explicitly being engineered by this Zaharoff figure, who's another one of these so-called nobility, Sir or Count Zaharoff or whatever, and Lord Milner. So here Milner comes into the picture, who is, again, the Rhodes Rothschild Milner operation to get Labor Fabian Lloyd George to support Bolsheviks.
Yeah, that guy Zaharoff was sort of, Basil Zaharoff was sort of the Edin Khashoggi of his era. He was like an international man of mystery, weapons and all that stuff.
Arms dealer, yeah.
Didn't he like sell like a submarine to Turkey's or Russia? Would have to buy a submarine. He like all these things. He's portrayed in that Sidney Reilly thing with Sam Neill.
Oh,
yeah, they have a character Zaharoff, and it's all about international trading and all that.
Yeah. I didn't realize that. Okay.
It's a pretty good show. It's sort of like a prototypical Bond thing, because that's the
benefit, right? Yeah,
of that. But it gets into the whole function of like huge arms contracts and spying and intrigue and all that. And he gets into the fake anti-Bolshevik cause in Russia that Dzerzhinsky under the Czech head start.
Operation Trust thing.
Yeah, the trust, and then that's how they capture Sidney Reilly, and that's how he meets his doom at the end of it. But there's a funny scene in it where Dzerzhinsky's talking with Stalin, and Dzerzhinsky says, "Oh, I have this program. I have a parallel government." Stalin goes, "What?" Shut it down right now. It's like, and Dzerzhinsky dies of a heart attack or something. But it was funny. It was a funny scene because you just see Stalin's character. Stalin's not going to like that. Mm-hmm. Parallel government out of his control and all that. Yeah, it's interesting. And talking to Mark about Rothschild, right? How it came out later that KGB colonel that said that Rothschild was meeting with Soviet intelligence, and
of course, yeah, which pretty much ensures that he's the fifth man.
Yeah, which means that, but the thing is, he wasn't a communist. He's controlling.
Exactly.
His family's controlling things in Russia. Ultimately, Soviet Union is controlled opposition. You know.
So. Yeah, and Arm and Hammer is another one of these figures like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Sutton mentions him too, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of very wealthy people in the West who seem to be infatuated with communism, Marxism, socialism, Fabianism. This character, William Boyce Thompson, another one of these Western magnates. I like that Sutton makes it a point to say that he was explicit that his only interest in supporting Bolshevism and communism was for capturing the post-war markets. So there you go. And that's exactly what's going on today. So the reason, I mean, if anybody wants to figure out, you know, why is Joe Biden and his son so involved in Ukraine? Well, this is why, to get involved in those markets, right?
Well, it's odd. So many political families are involved in boondoggles in Ukraine, like Nancy Pelosi's niece and aid program. There's some like the billion-dollar program teaching soccer to Ukrainians or something someone's cashing in on. And not to mention, you know, Burisma and the whole scandal there with Biden openly admits it at the Council of Foreign Relations. He goes, "Son of a bitch, the man was fired." You know, they have on tape talking about he pressured the Ukrainian government to fire the prosecutor that was looking into Burisma, that his son was making like, I don't know, what was it like? He had some sort of, I don't know, it was like $100,000 a month or so, or $50,000 a month or something, just sitting on a, you know, is Hunter Biden who's, you know, with whores and taking dick pics of putting on his computer.
Yeah. Right. It was crazy to do. But it reminds me too that another way to demonstrate that this is all the case is this character, Bruce Lockhart. So this is the the famous British spy, whose memoirs I just bought, by the way, because I was so interested in this element of the story, because Mark Hacker dug up, turns out Bruce Lockhart was buddies with Crowley. So you know, this ties into the Dr. Robert Spence,
and Crowley acted as a German agent, right?
Yes.
I mean, but he really wasn't. The idea was he was posing as it, because he would he would produce this sort of ridiculous pro-German propaganda that would turn Americans off, off to Germans. That was his function of that newspaper.
Yeah. The newspaper propagandist. And then
you had degeneracy, of course, the Crowley. So there, back to that.
But Lockhart is a friend with Crowley, and he's the official go-between from the British government, MI6, to the Bolsheviks. So in other words, they kind of did the same thing with that they did with Hitler later on, the British government, where they had a dual policy, where they had there wasn't a clear public support for Bolshevism, but there was the private support for it through this Lockhart character, who was himself also apparently a Fabian. So he was a fan of socialism. As we said, friends with Crowley. And then there was another guy who also apparently, I read a separate book on the relationship between Viktor Rothschild and his possibility of being the fifth man. And it mentioned another guy named James Rusbridger, who I'd never heard of, is another British intelligence guy who left and basically says a lot of the same stuff, that this is all managed dialectics. His book is The Illusions and Delusions of International Espionage. And we also should mention Dr. John Coleman, who, you know, as far as I know, claimed to have been previously British intelligence, and also admitted all this stuff as well in his Committee of 300 book. Mm-hmm. So again, there's just so much, you know, direct evidence, especially when you get into these spy figures, you know, admitting to this being really a managed dialectic.
So it would appear, because if you look at all the policies, they appear to be just that, because they don't seem to make any sense from a standpoint of geopolitics, if you're thinking from a nation state standpoint, you know.
And Sutton says that actually MI6 Bruce Lockhart was actually not the government agent. He was the Lord Milner agent. So he was basically doing these operations for Milner, who was basically running the show. So this is the real secret government, in other words. And that's exactly what Quigley says in Anglo-American Establishment.
Yeah, the occult empire, you know, called Octopus, these financial, again, it became the City of London, these transnational, transatlantic financial interests that are really controlling it. And I was listening to an interview with Whitney Webb. She came out with a book called One Nation, One World Under Bribery or something. She has a two-set volume book that she just published about research of blackmail and bribery and corruption, dating back to, I think goes back to the Second World War with Operation Underworld and Lansky and all that stuff. Lucky Luciano, but the corruption of it all. But anyway, she was talking about Jeffrey Epstein and how the sex crimes, you know, the lurid sex crimes that we hear about it are really just a part of sort of this financial and political crimes that are occurring. And she says these, you know, why they're into some of the mRNA and genome and biological research is, well, because once you control all the money, you don't really, it's not about money, it's about control. And so now they're trying to, sort of the biosecurity, you know, we're talking World War I, World War II, their national security is used to consolidate power, undermine governments, and create, you know, multipolarity to bipolarity, to unipolarity, which may be cracking up now with Putin. But now the biosecurity is a pretext, you know, fear, ultimately fear, you know, the fear of something. And now that's being used to manipulate people.
That's why we need, you know, the total global ID, the tracking and tracing, Gates Foundation, Gavi, you know, we need the, yeah, all that is justified on the basis of the new biosecurity system, because they don't really, it's not about printing money anymore. It's about just total control. Exactly.
And we need digital currency because money can spread germs. Even in most credit cards now, anyway, they're 90% of the way to that.
but to be clear, they're going to want a centralized, controllable digital currency.
Yes, that's what's
CBD. About the ones that they like. In fact, I had hope for Ethereum, but now Ethereum is basically transitioned into becoming a centralized Klaus coin. And World Economic Forum's even openly saying, oh, we actually like Ethereum now. So Ethereum might unfortunately end up being Klaus coin. But yeah, I still believe in Bitcoin. So I think it's decentralized and not, that's why they all, BIS, all these people, they come out and say that, you know, Bitcoin's the real evil thing. Hillary says it, Bill Gates says it. Mm-hmm. They want you to get on the centralized crypto. So that's where I think they're new. At first they were like, oh, all crypto's bad. But now I think they've realized that they can't really stop crypto. So they might as well just go with whatever will be the best, you know, Fed coin, international Fed coin or whatever. I did want to point out too that there was this figure, I think he was an anarcho guy who got arrested and interrogated also by somebody's secret police. Maxim Gorky.
Oh, Maxim Gorky, yeah.
This guy was funny because he's like, oh yeah, I figured out that all of this is a joke, it's a scam, and everything is being done as a giant science experiment, which is interesting because that's the way that H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell describe Bolshevism, as a giant science experiment.
Interesting. So he's sort of this idealistic, naive libertarian, if you will.
Yeah.
And he helps destroy all that, and then he realizes he's been a dupe.
Yeah, exactly. And there's certainly, yeah. Oh, and then another parallel was the American Red Cross and its connections to Odessa. So the USA supports the Bolsheviks in Germany and places propaganda flyers everywhere, and through the Red Cross is supporting agitation in Odessa. And at one point, Lenin is agitating in Kiev. So does this sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Humanitarian operations agitating in Odessa and Kiev. It's a replay, right, of 100 years ago, basically.
They didn't have trannies yet, though, did they?
Literally 100 years ago, almost.
Yeah.
Got the same thing going on. And yeah, that's a good point, though. Would they have been actually, the trans stuff was actually popular in Weimar Republic.
Oh, Germany, yeah. Magnus Hirschfeld, yeah. And all that. Yeah.
Probably not at this point in Odessa.
His research. That was the first place that the Nazis burned down or something. It's Magnus Hirschfeld's clinic. He's hightailed it out of there. Mm-hmm. A pioneer in transgender research. It was like, it's a torture chamber, you know.
Out of Tavistock, right? So all that stuff's being pushed literally openly by Tavistock. And Tavistock was a Fabian creation.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, the Fabians, I think either a Roman general or a pop star from the late 50s.
You know? Was there a one called Fabian?
Oh, it's funny. You were a different general. Yeah, there's Fabian was one of these pretty boy pop stars. look him up.
Does come from the general. You're right about that. But
yeah. But they just from the general, because it's a gradual approach to things, right? That's where they get their name.
Yeah, for a bigger enemy, rather than outright attack, it's better to do a slow kill, gradualist approach. And so that was the approach of the Roman general against the Carthaginians. And so the name is just derived for this slow motion socialism, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And the attitude was always to align itself with monopoly capital. It was never anti-capitalist. It saw it as a necessary means to an end. I'm saying the actual on the street ideology, never mind the inner secret zillionaire funding. That was always the case. But the Fabians were more public and doctrinaire about, no, we actually need to align ourselves with democracy. And this is funny because early Marx agreed with that, but then he flipped. No, we don't need to ally with democracy. You know, democracy is fundamentally bourgeoisie and this kind of stuff. So what we need is direct revolution, right? And the Fabians said, no, this is never going to work. You're never going to. And they were right, because that didn't happen, right? You never. Marx was wrong about the workers actually, you know, doing the world revolution. So the Fabians are more correct that from a strategic standpoint, that it would be much better to do this slow kill model, whereby you do it in phases. The first phase is to align yourself with liberal democracy and money, big money. Then what you do is you, through policy, through culture, through essentially what they call permeation, you socialize the entire culture. But the socialization process is always, in terms of the inner core, for the purpose of big money. So it's just a scheme to nationalize everything and then consolidate the wealth for a few small private oligarchs.
And they'll pursue that centralization or nationalization any means necessary or practical. Absolutely. I mean, ideology, libertarian, communism, whatever.
Oh, including blackmail, including subterfuge, which apparently many of the Fabians were big fans of.
Which we still see today, because that's, yeah. You know, compromise is a big thing, sexual compromise. But yeah, this idea goes back to the Industrial Revolution, where you had the consolidation of these interests and their power. And you see this with the Milner groups, South Africa, the mining companies like an Anglo-American corporation. You had the Royal Mint refinery that the Rothschilds controlled. Rothschild sons banking. It's all coordinated. You know, then you have the rise of British Petroleum or the Shell, Standard Oil. They all kind of get together and they collude. Instead of competing, they start colluding. And same thing with U.S. British Steel, Bank of England, the creation of the Federal Reserve System, the international drug trade, at that time opium. Of course, this creates huge, banking interests like Shanghai, Hong Kong, Shanghai banking. So what I'm saying, trying to get here is, people, how could you have a global conspiracy? Well, you have a global conspiracy because you have a integrated network of corporations all communicating with each other and coordinating. And relative to the population of the world, this is a very small group of people who intermarry, have the same interests. They developed the same worldview coming out of sort of the British cosmology that came out of the Reformation, this whole idea of, you know, Malthusianism is a big thing with these people. You always see
Malthusianism. All the Fabians are pro-eugenics.
So if you do the history, like, I can see they all hang out at the same parties, they're all screwing each other, you know, drinking tea and all that, you know, hey, we can, we work together, we can control the world. So it's like meeting the five families, so this case, it's not a
higher level organized crime.
High level organized crime, and that's how this is organized. The world government, Commonwealth of Nations, League of Nations, international rules. If you have international trade, you need international rules, right? Free trade requires free trade agreements.
Their argument, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the absurd contradictions, right, throughout this system only make sense when you understand it at this level, right? Just think about Klaus. I mean, you know, a lot of people have been talking about how, why would this wealthy guy, you know, the head of the World Economic Forum, be sitting there with a bust of Lenin behind him?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure you've seen that picture, right?
Yes.
Well, this is why, because Leninism was actually allied to Fabianism as well. In fact, Lenin's wife, Krupskaya, is who translated Beatrice Webb's books for Russia. There's a direct connect between, Leninism and Fabianism. And then the idea is scientific governance, right? This is the whole plan of all these people. And that's why it's not out of accord with monopolistic capitalism, because it also believes in so-called scientific governance. Or that's their term, of course. But I mean, that is the modus operandi of the technocratic World Economic Forum, is scientific governance. So from the Fabians of 100 years ago to Klaus, there's a 100% direct ideological lineage. And that's really what we're getting at with this Rothschild book, is this is the, if you want to understand the key ideology that's going on, how is it that Europe became, socialist, the EU is socialist, how did this occur? How do we get these socialist organizations like the IMF, World Bank, and United Nations? Well, it's because of these people. These are the people behind those institutions on record. And it's not Marxism. It's elements of all of the systems into one, which is essentially big state socialism, which is identical to big state capitalism. That's the point. That's Rothschild's thesis, is that big state socialism is big state capitalism. So if you want to understand the model, you know, look at something like China.
Yeah, China is kind of like their dream. And of course, China was set up by the Rockefellers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Kissinger's mission in the 70s. This is all part of the that mid-70s setup with the petrodollar and the collapse, closing the gold window Right. And this facilitates the deindustrialization of the United States. At the same time, you have the economic elites in Europe. I think it was a Rambouillet conference where they decided to move textile production out of Europe into the cheaper labor markets of Asia, I think, at the time. But then, again, this sort of leveraging humanity. And, of course, a lot of these countries that are destabilized have been victimized by economic hitman. And it produces a lot of surplus labor there in the cities because they've been pushed off the land. So also you can build a factory and have cheap labor. Then you can also create an immigration crisis. You can, with trade agreements, what was the thing with Russ Perot, the NAFTA, mm-hmm. which destroyed a lot of Mexican agriculture,
right.
And sent them up north, flooding Mexico with cheap subsidized corn. Again, the market isn't the market, because at each stage of the game, prices are being manipulated. A good example is recently with OPEC. You know, it's like, wait a second, they decide, it's a political decision, decide how much oil to produce. It's nothing to do with international pricing, free market pricing. It's a political decision. The same way that the CIA got OPEC to flood the market in the 70s to hurt the Soviet Union. You know, it wasn't the triumph of capitalism. This was a political decision, you know, that won the Cold War, not to mention the spiritual religious aspects that helped. Michael Jones makes a good point about this, about 1979, how you had, you know, Margaret Thatcher and the rise of Reaganism, also had Pope John Paul II, and you had Ayatollah Khomeini, sort of a revolt against materialism. At the same time, you had the rise of capitalism, and for a short while, the religious figures like Khomeini and more John Paul II had this alliance with the West, with capitalism. But then once the Soviet Union ended, that alliance was bound to collapse, which it has now, because now you have, it's open that Western what's called capitalism in the West, is openly hostile to any, you know, metaphysical or religious transcendent values. Mm-hmm. It's just being destroyed, even nature itself, right? I mean, so yeah, it's one of these things where people tend to look at these events and they spin the narratives that's supportive of their own bias or their worldview, which is very human, I guess. But it isn't exactly what we thought it was. It wasn't the triumph of Thatcherism or Reaganism that won the Cold War. Much more was going on. And it was a culmination of decades of decisions and events that, you know, that played out. And of course, that it wasn't history ending either, was it? It wasn't the end of history. Because we can see with the Great Reset, they have all types of plans.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, those were phases to bring us to the point where we would, according to what they want to do, is integrate the continents into the continental unions. And that's why the EU, I was under the impression actually 5 years ago when I read Esalen's book that the EU was planned in the 40s and 50s at the first Bilderberg meetings. And that's partly true, but actually the EU was planned in the 1920s and 30s by the Fabians and people like Count Kalergi. That was actually the earliest stages of they originally wanted to call it the United States of Europe.
Yeah.
But that's the real origins of the EU.
And miscegenation was a big part of his agenda, destroying ethnicities. That's a resistance to
globalism. Everyone who's one. Yeah. So then the Fabians then had this explicit policy of the total open border for creating the monoculture, the blob, basically.
Yeah. And we see that now with the migration, weaponized migration.
And it's funny too, because Ratu noticed that what seems to be going on here is that global capitalism essentially is what builds the integrated global order for the socialists. And then the socialists come on the scene and say, this infrastructure has been built for us. So let's give everybody universal basic income. Let's get everybody tracked and traced. Let's control every, did you see the, who was the guy, the BIS guy, the big fat triple chin BIS guy.
Talk about stereotypical banker.
Yeah, he says,
I saw him.
Every single transaction through the electronic currency and shut down anything that we want. So
yeah,
that's socialism, right? That's complete, total, universally basic income socialism. And that's what H.G. Wells had said. Remember, he said to the idiot Marxist, he says, why are you against capitalism? That's what's going to build the global order for us.
Well, you make that point about Karl Marx. Karl Marx saw capitalism as a necessity in the development and the dialectic.
Right. Yeah.
He wasn't anti-capitalist. He just saw it as an essential part of it.
That was one of the phases. Correct.
But the rise of monopoly, and now with today, of course, with Fabianism, these things, with technocracy, which we see sort of part of the Great Reset, and with all, I mean, technocracy is part of this digital currency, because that now they have the bandwidth and the technology to track and trace things, so they think they can actually bring about technocracy. Because technocracy, you know, was popular in the 30s and during the Great Depression, when the apparent failure of capitalism. You know, a lot of crackpot ideas.
We're in a mirrored situation right now where people think that because the economy is collapsing, these people step forward as you know, and technocracy is a form of socialism, right? To say, look, see, politicians, they're a bunch of stupid idiots up there on the screen. They don't know anything. Capitalism doesn't work because it's, a bunch of people being greedy. Don't you want to be ruled by experts? Don't you want to be ruled by science and reason? And that's how it's this false solution to a monopolistic capitalist problem to begin with.
Which is that the experts are paid for by college dropouts like Bill Gates.
Yeah.
it's a cover for oligarch.
Exactly right, yeah.
And then you have a Klaus Schwab who dons a sort of technocratic uniform, his Bond villain. Mm-hmm. Technocratic, you know, because you see those outfits that you call them technocrats, the advocates of technocracy. They have hundreds of thousands of members. You could like order special cars and suits and all that stuff. They had a huge gathering at the Hollywood Bowl. Robert Wood writes about this. And Howard Scott, I think, King Hubbard were the two guys. And Howard Scott, apparently, he was over there at Columbia. He started it. And he got an office there at Columbia. He got like some basement floor to operate out of. But then they found out he was a complete fraud. They kicked him out. Then he lived in King Hubbard's apartment or something. But he's the one that came up with the idea of I think fossil fuels, one of the few earlier ones, advocates of it to create an idea of false scarcity.
I was just listening to Fletcher Prouty talking about how the whole phraseology is a PR thing to create a false idea of scarcity.
Yeah, and I think they get the oral depletion tax or something, because that's one of the things, the reasons they think Kennedy might have been off. One of the many reasons why Kennedy was off, because he was pushing for the repeal of the oral depletion tax. So he made another enemy there. That's he had the mistake of thinking he was president. No problem with Biden, right? You don't have to blow a president's head off when his head is already shot. No point assassinating Biden, wouldn't make a difference. Shoot him in the head. With the technocracy and technocracy kind of, you know, of course, obviously the 30s Great Depression, some of these kind of these crackpot ideas that have become popular because of the apparent failure of capitalism. But then the war comes and the war kind of changes everything. And the post-war boom, which was secured by America's destruction of Europe. Doing it again now with the pipelines. Maybe we're talking that before the night is over. Current events factor in this, of course. The Mackinder thesis lives on, but it kind of gets dropped. Then it's picked up in the 70s, I think, when David Rockefeller taps. Was he at Columbia where he found him?
I can't remember if he found him at Columbia or McGill, but
then he becomes the first director of the Trilateral Commission.
Right.
And they start working towards this sort of this technocratic order. And I think part of that, Biden's now openly talking about digital currencies, and these plans were laid in the 70s when they destroyed the Bretton Woods system and repudiated gold, because fiat currencies are always destined to destruction, given the proclivities of those who are entrusted to create the money supply, which is these privately owned central banks.
Yes, and did you hear the analysis I did of Joseph Nye's soft power essay?
Yes, I want to get into that, because I listened to that just before I started this.
As I was rereading it before I did that the other day, I forgot he mentions that was a pivotal point in the economy, right, in terms of, now all these people are from the Kennedy School, and they're all a bunch of quasi-Fabians or Keynesians, right? Mm-hmm. So like he's talking, he basically admitting that like this was a huge, like, I mean, he's not saying it's bad. He's saying that basically moving into a debt-based system was sped up, you know, super speed by that act.
Mm-hmm.
And he ends that whole essay by saying that, what's the solution to all this? Gigantic taxes on everybody. More and more tax. I mean, it's like we were saying before the show, right? Like, it's like they know what, they're experts at screwing stuff up. So to call this like incompetency is just really not fair to how talented these people are at destroying. it's not incompetency. Like, they have to know that taxing the crap out of everybody, which is what he says at the end of that. He says, we need a global government and taxing the crap out of everybody. That will fix things. You mean fix things for you, right? The elite, to by destroying things for everybody else.
Well, that's what that's sort of the pump and dump, and they run the debt up so high.
Well, this is a two-step that quickly mentioned, right? So you have the decades of the pumping and the Wall Street gone wild, and then you get the collapse, which is done by design. They pop the bubble, and then the FDR types step in and they call for the socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And all that does is run up a decade of debt for all these public works projects, which Quigley says was all in debt to the bankers. I mean, who's paying for that?
Yeah, because we have a system where the Treasury theoretically could print its money, which really, by the lights of the Constitution, it should be the case because the Coinage Act. But that power was given in the Constitution to the Federal Reserve in 1913.
Yeah.
And what happens is the Treasury will issue bonds, and they sell it to the Treasury, to the Fed, and the Fed, you know, with the open market committee, there's a whole system there, but basically the money is created at debt as opposed to,
right,
you know, a monetary system.
Right.
Why is that? Well, who's the creditor here? We don't know who really owns the Bank of National Settlements.
Right.
In the Federal Reserve. Yeah.
And that's done on purpose, though, to loot each generation is the point, which Quigley more or less admits, which most people don't figure out, right? You and I did that podcast a long time ago about how the boom bust cycle's rigged.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. The point is that whole section on FDR is basically admitting this, right? Like, because of the boom, Wall Street, and then depression collapse, then you get the government saying, we'll fix it with all these public works projects. But who's paying for all the public works projects? It's not the public. It's debt, right? Future generations to the banking elite.
Compound interest.
They do the same thing when, after the wars, right, they go and they put Germany into debt for generations.
Mm-hmm.
Quigley admits that.
That's right. And then it's repudiated, and then you have a war. Funny how that works out.
The socialists play the role of coming along and saying, let's nationalize everything. And then when they nationalize everything, that's basically just going to paying off the debts that the socialists run up. And then you get a reaction against socialism. And then the people want the free market, you know, no regulations to, you know, go, let's go back to the conservative principles. And then you get the bubble that grows up from the so-called free market, which is also manipulated. Right. So they just kind of go back and forth as two step.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was Charles Lindbergh Sr. who said that when they create the Federal Reserve System, that booms and busts would be scientifically created. He could see it.
Well, isn't the Federal Reserve System one of the planks of Marx's communist manifesto?
Yeah, yeah. And it's because his chief mission was to defend the value of the dollar. Well, how's that work out? You know, it's lost 99% of the value since the Fed was created in 1913. Mm-hmm. But someone profits off the inflation because it's ultimately a counterfeiting scheme. There's always someone who benefits from that. But we get an idea because in that soft power lecture, you talk about this.
Wasn't that a joke somebody made? I'm sorry to cut you off, but it might have been you. Somebody called the FBI to report counterfeiting, and it was the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, he called the Treasury guys coming to check what's going on here. Quantitative easing. Yeah. But remember, someone benefits from that. And of course, we saw that with the pandemic and the bailout of Wall Street under Trump, when you had BlackRock was given $6 trillion to save the stock market. And so who, where does that money come from? It's not like, you know, the Federal Reserve chairman is breaking his piggy bank saying, here, go spend it. They're just creating the money, right? You know, again, debt's going up and up, and they're acquiring assets, the whole time. But this speaks to the whole debt crisis, because it was in August of 2019 that you had the meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. This, apparently, central bankers have this meeting no one cares about, you know.
Well, now they because supposedly we hang on the decisions of Jackson Hole, and the whole economy goes up or down on the basis of it.
Yeah, but no, exactly. But they decided what they call going direct, and that would be where the central banks pretty much take over the fiscal policies of a sovereign government, meaning sovereign governments lose their sovereignty. And in fact, the very plan that was submitted by BlackRock at Jackson Hole went into effect, supposedly in response to the economic crisis brought about by the declared pandemic. And I think this speaks to, you had the point was, this is debt. I think in the West, they've leveraged debt so far that they want to bring it down, and the only way they could start this bailout scheme without having massive inflation was to have the lockdown and suppress demand. And that's how you manage it with this. That's one of the functions that the pandemic served.
Oh, I see. Interesting.
And at the same time, it preserves the value of the dollar during this transition period. Now you have Biden coming out saying, "Yeah, we need digital currencies," you know, as he's destroying the dollar, running up the debt.
Right.
But then with this, what we saw with the pandemic and the lockdowns is this huge transfer of wealth to these mega corporations like Walmart or Amazon and BlackRock.
Right.
And they're the ones, they're implementing ESG, which is environmental social governance, right? And so they're the ones.
Social credit score, yeah.
Yeah, and social credit score. And this is where you, in your talk, you talk about how, wait a second, there will come a time when these corporations are more powerful than governments.
Yeah, no, I talked about that, yeah.
Yeah, and apparently we're seeing that occur today. Now, right. You know, with Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates. I don't know if they're
Apple already has a bigger GDP than several, you know, small companies. So yeah.
And if the Federal Credit and the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve have been essentially been seized, then these corporations can leverage their billions to control the trillions that they can create to acquire the resources. This is how, you know, good example is Bill Gates. Works with the World Health Organization, which people think is sort of an official organization, but he's selecting who runs it, this dictator out of Ethiopia, Tedros, who has like a sociology degree or something. So he works with the World Health Organization, various universities, various public health officials that have been seated throughout various governments.
Tedros is a Marxist, by the way.
And this is the function of Davos, right? Coordinating this stuff. And you have Klaus Schwab's agents in the Canadian government, various governments, cabinets, and they can declare a pandemic, which then results in a huge flow of wealth towards people like Bill Gates, who can turn around and buy up farmland on the cheap.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And then you have someone like Jeff Bezos, who's building yachts that don't fit under bridges in Europe. The solution is to buy the bridge, raise it, let the boat go through. And if you say, wait a second, we live in a society where young couples can't even afford a house, can't even get married, and you're spending $20 million to spend 10 minutes in space, or you're building yachts that are too big to fit under bridges in Europe, that's something wrong with that. And I was talking about that, and I had siblings say, what are you, a communist?
Yeah, right.
I'm a communist. If you see something wrong with this situation,
they don't understand that the real communists are Bill Gates and oligarch type people. Because one of the things that Rotzier noticed that the Fabians explicitly said was that their number one enemy was basically middle class and Christian conservative type people. That's the thing standing in the way of world socialism. And also the HUL says that too. He's like, really the main enemy here is Christianity. Like all the other religions are cool. In fact, the Fabians are the ones that really pioneered the Islamicization of the UK and by extension Europe as well. This was one of their strategies, was that because they thought that socialism was much more amenable to an Islamic model than anything else. and they thought they could sort of commandeer and, you know, kind of socially engineer Muhammad to be this sort of harbinger of Fabian socialism. So I didn't actually know that that was a big reason for how the UK was basically is Londonistan, right? And I went over there in 2018 to speak at the Alternative View conference, and it is Londonistan, right?
Yeah, apparently they have riots now with Hindus and Muslims. They actually brought in Hindus and Muslims and put them in the same neighborhoods.
In the same neighborhood.
Did you hear anything about the partition in India back in 1948? There's a little problem there. That's why Pakistan was created.
Yeah, but that's why Europe, too, the importation of Islam is an intentional Fabian strategy. I didn't actually know that. I mean, I knew about the British imperial, you know, alignments with various types of, you know, Islam and St. John Hunt and, you know, T.E. Lawrence. I mean, I know about all that, but more specifically into the 20th century, after those guys, you have all these different Fabians helped to set up all of these Islamic centers and even Sufi centers. So Sufism's connection to British intelligence is precisely through this this avenue, which is actually documented in other places. I think in the Golden Fitzgerald, they talk about how Western intelligence, for example, utilized Sufi networks in Afghanistan for drug trade. Mm-hmm. And that's because a lot of these Fabian and elite British intelligence people had a fascination with Sufism as well, because Sufism is really just kind of mystical ecumenist Islam. So it fits well with their project. And this is why, for example, Prince Charles, you know, has had these public statements about, you know, his affinity for Sufism and Islam.
Despite the fact that he's officially the head of the Anglican Church and it's a state church, you think he, as head of the church, he would protect that religion within his realm, but he's undermining it.
I think that's like the fakest.
Yeah, I know.
Organization out there, but yeah, I mean, it's a great point, right? Like, well, wait a minute, I thought that the head of the Anglican Church would be a Christian. No, actually, he's into all the religions, right? Which is the perfect example of the, you know, this really this New Agey model. And actually, all of the founders of the New Age stuff, Besant, Blavatsky, and Bailey, they were all Fabians, which I didn't realize. I knew one of them was. I didn't realize all three of them were. And this is the connection between the Blavatsky, Besant, Bailey network and Bolshevism, because they were all connected to Rorik, who was a Bolshevik agent, closely connected with Wallace, right? Who, and Rorik is who told Wallace to put the whole thing on the dollar bill.
That was Henry Wallace, the vice president and then agriculture secretary for FDR.
And then the theosophist, Blavatsky, Bailey, Besant women, that's where the New Age movement comes from. Mm-hmm. It's literally from them. So all of that New Age stuff in the 60s counterculture was being, again, pioneered by Fabians. The Fabians were doing the 60s counterculture stuff back in the, turn of the century and putting it into the public arts, right? They were doing these like degenerate, blasphemous public artworks that would premiere on the BBC and premiere in public station and public places. So they were actually experimenting with this degenerate cultural warfare stuff, you know, decades before the degenerate social Marxists were doing it, or cultural Marxists.
Yeah, so this the cult of mysticism, Eastern stuff, shot with the Beatles and going to India and, you know, all that nonsense.
Yeah, that was pioneered by these, New Age British agents, basically. And that this is probably why there's a lot of speculation that Blavatsky was a British agent, too.
And you have the World Council of Churches, I think, which is there to promote that ecumenism.
Yeah, it's also a Fabian creation as well.
Yeah. And for the longest time, people thought it was a communist front. I remember that.
If by communism you mean Fabian, Fabian capitalist oligarchs, yes.
That's how you water down and destroy Christianity, by promoting ecumenism, because it's obviously. The strength of Christianity is its claim of the one true faith. And if you water it down.
What's the Fabian strategy in terms of social theory, right? Slow permeation. Well, then that's just the application of that strategy to the religious sphere, religious engineering through slow ecumenist strategy.
Exactly. It's like promoting gay marriage to destroy marriage. They came out and said, we want to end marriage. That wouldn't work. But you promote so-called gay marriage and that erodes the institution. Oh, that and other forms of degeneracy, of course, mm-hmm. no-fault divorce and mm-hmm. feminism and, you know, because you want to destroy, situations like the United States where you have people, local communities, a relatively stable population, they're going to organize and they're going to be able to form labor unions to demand higher wages. But if you break the community down, create suburbia, provide cheap loans for homes, bust them, send them to the suburbs, everyone becomes mobile and cosmopolitan. No one has any sense of community, loyalty to any particular piece of land. And then you can sort of exploit their guilt. This is how they exploit some racial issues, how you kind of create white guilt. So you destroy the basis for any belief in heritage America. And then you can flood the country. And of course, if you point out the fact that communities are being ruined, the country's demographics are becoming untenable, you're a racist, because that's used against you.
Yeah, George Bernard Shaw was one of the first to say we need to get rid of white people.
Yeah. Yeah. What? Does he mean himself?
good question. Well, one thing that Razia points out is that all these people are always tremendous hypocrites, right? Mm-hmm. So, no, typically they mean everybody but themselves. So
I just don't see many black people Indians checking out his plays. That's all.
Yeah, and he makes this point with, like, for example, one of the Fabianists, the International Fabian International Bureau or something like this. They have a 3-point platform, which is world peace through world disarmament, comprehensive disarmament through world government, and world government is achieved through the United Nations. So this is their International Bureau's 3-point platform plan. But then he goes on to say that, like, the same people were also saying, well, this doesn't mean that we won't have a Fabian world army. It doesn't mean that we'll be disarmed. Right. So he's just pointing out, like, how often they contradict.
Well, that goes to the idea that the cause of war is, like, nation states and nationalism. So you do it.
And that's exactly what the Fabians said. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, then how do you oppose this world order? Oh, okay. So you have, like, NATO destroying.
I have a war to end all the nations.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have, like, NATO taking out Gaddafi or, bombing Syria, undermining.
This is why Ratu points out that this is who Orwell's talking about. Ingsoc is the Fabians.
Yeah. And I guess how you get to 1984 is first you need Brave New World, right? I used to think there are two competing visions.
They're just phases.
They're phases because to get to that, it's this idea where you create so much disorder and the dictator has to come in.
I think that, to be precise, like Orwell thought that the English socialism might turn into Stalinism. And so that's what 1984 is. But in reality, the Fabian model is Brave New World, which is the slow, degeneracy drug pleasure model, which actually also could turn into the dictator model too, right? So maybe they're just phases.
It's just the phase. So well, Jay, I think we covered it.
Okay.
So so of course Jay's analysis, jaysanalysis.com. Where are we here? You have of course you're the author of Esoteric Hollywood and Esoteric Hollywood 2. And recently published Meta-Narratives, Essays on Philosophy and Symbolism. Is this a compilation of articles edited and published?
It is, yeah. It's 15 philosophy articles on various topics. And then also have the Red Book out, which is a book that I didn't put together. I don't know who did it. It wasn't really what I wanted, but I can't stop it because I tried getting it taken down and it just goes wrong. I thought, well, I might as well just sell it if I can't get them to stop doing it. And it's not bad. It's not ideal. But it's basically just kind of everything directly taken from the blog. That's about 660 pages of philosophy, theology, geopolitics. So there's also the Red Book if you want that. But yeah, those are the two books that are out. If you get the Red Book, don't get Meta-Narratives, because all those philosophy essays are in the Red Book.
Okay.
Just want the philosophy essays in a, you know, better aesthetically presented format than you want the Meta-Narratives book.
And of course, Jay's analysis is still $4.95 a month.
Correct. Yeah, I was just thinking the other day, like, how come I can't I'm screwed over when it comes to inflation, because, you know, I chose that price
like back in
2016. So
it's not indexed for inflation.
All right. I'm stuck forever with
like, so basically it's like it's probably like equivalent to $1.25 now or something.
I was gonna say, yeah, what I'll have to check the inflation from 2015 or 16 now, but it's probably down quite a bit. Anyway, yeah, it's still $4.95 a month. There's also the Rockfin. You can, you know, follow me there as well. If you want access to, you know, Whitney Webb and Richard Grove and Jason Burmis and all those other people as well on Rockfin, or you can also do it on my website.
Great. Okay. Well, Jay, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.